It's nice to be here with you all. And I, that you got me there, Jake, so there you go. Where's Liza? There she is. She's like my Nielsen meter, Liza. So if her face goes up, I know I'm on a roll. If it goes down, I need to change directions quickly. And if she starts pointing at her watch, well, then we're in trouble. So there we go. I find myself, and I'm just processing the entire conference. And as Drew was saying, you know, in his great, incredibly lifelike sounding Sean Connery accent, you know, that we're going down deep. And I know I'm always surprised, and I guess I shouldn't be, that after 6 years I am excavating or finding things being brought up in my own life and in my own experience of the gospel that is unique to this room, in fact, and unique to these people. And so I was so touched by the reading that Sally Lloyd-Jones gave that I'm still haven't really come down from that. And so if I burst into tears or start laughing, I don't know what's going to happen, but there you go. I'm also a little, with respect to what we just heard, my talk is can be understood in light of that. We didn't talk about them before as somewhat of a, I wouldn't say deepening, but maybe an echo or a perspective on the whole concept of how and where and when and exactly what is the connecting point between, as it were, the faithful set of believers and the rest of the world. Because the discussion about how and why and exactly what takes place when someone even becomes a Christian, or at least is confronted with the Christian message and its definite abstractions, well, the question is actually begged in that statement about what constitutes an abstraction and who is to decide what is or is not abstract. And I'm most reminded by this in my own life by a man named Peter Berger, who I think, Simon can correct me, came up with the sociological concept of what he referred to as plausibility structures. And what we're involved with here is essentially offering an entirely foreign and abstract sounding contrary plausibility structure to the default position of the world. And so when we end up talking about things that are by their very definition almost not abstract, like sex or procreation or eating or vocation, if you want to call it that, well then when you're operating from a completely different plausibility structure than something that is, as it were, outside of your entire ability to even comprehend something other than what you were doing, well, that will in fact be crazy. It'll sound crazy. You mean I can only have one wife? You mean I can't subjugate my slaves? You mean I can't do anything I want to with my body? You are crazy. And you begin to get a picture of what the audacity, in particular the Apostle Paul, had to walk into a world that would have said these things about their lives and their bodies and their families, and he was giving them, as it were, an entirely different world. And I have this on good authority, in fact, and I recommend highly anyone that's interested, a book by the name of The Apostle Paul Reimagined is what it's called, by a professor at Yale named Sarah Rudin. And she was actually just a classicist who I think has the definitive translation of Aeschylus. Justin, you can help me on that. Anyway, she's a lot smarter than I am, and certainly knows Greek better. And she picked up the New Testament just as sort of a thought exercise and had to end up writing a book about it simply because she said, no one seems to understand how radical this book was to the world in which it was delivered. And particularly the Apostle Paul's teaching on the relationship between, or the rewriting, as it were, of what was then known as the household codes, would have been tantamount to someone running through here claiming all number of crazy things. And yet, it changed the world. So what we're involved with here is actually looking at why did it change the world, because that it changed the world is undeniable. And underneath that why is how is it that we actually hear, and why do we hear this message of the gospel? So that was a little bit of an aside. So if I added 5 minutes, I'm sorry, Dave. But it does go into this, because I was thinking about Kierkegaard. I also love Kierkegaard, and I love Kim Kierkegaard-Ashian also. And I was reminded, Dave and I just recently read an article, apparently at the same time, and there was a quote by, I did not find it, but it was in an article from a work that I had not read by Kierkegaard called A Point of View for My Work as an Author. And he had this amazing statement where he says, "Illusion can never be destroyed directly, and only by indirect means can it be radically removed." And I thought that was a fitting way to begin this talk on the law in particular, because what we are involved with here in Mockingbird, and what I in fact believe the Christian church is in the in its ideal situation propagating, is a an indirect, radical attack on the illusions by which everyone is operating. And in order for it to be, to have someone have the audacity to claim it's an illusion, well, then we have to backtrack and again go to the question of authority and revelation, and ultimately, who says? Well, who are you to tell me this? Who are you who points out the illusion of the rest of our lives? And that's what we're involved with here, because we are those people who say there is one great non-abstract reality to all human existence that then begs the question by which we are all judged, and that is the existence of death. Now, yay, this is fun. Yay, in the afternoon, let's talk about death. And, and then we're going to go have, we're all going to like march to, to Colorado, if you know what I mean. But so we're talking about, I was reminded of this, while if you watch the end of Annie Hall, they're in a bookstore, and they're talking, and Woody Allen says, the two type of people in the world, the tragic, and why I mean tragic, I mean, really terribly handicapped or have some sort of debilitating disease, and then the miserable and everyone else, And what's interesting about that for me is that there's a book that he's holding, if you notice, and it's called The Denial of Death by this sociologist and psychologist named Peter Becker. And if you begin to process what he may or may not have been saying, the point of Peter Becker's book is that, Ernst Becker, excuse me, is that the all-encompassing reality of death is such a profoundly disorienting reality in people's lives that we must, in fact, create worlds by which we can operate that essentially deny its impending reality. So this world may look like an army or a nationality or an ethnicity or an academic career that you want to have, or any of the things that we actually call the law. These will be plausibility structures within which you live until you don't live. And what we begin to operate in is we begin to see that the touchstone for human existence with respect to what are we doing here is in fact this fact that it ends. And so when I wrote this paper, I mean, this is a back way of getting into this paper, Bigfoot Called My Unicorn an Antinomian. This was a post that was written probably, 3 years into our existence here as a Mockingbirds. And it was written sort of as a out of a deep place of frustration with a continued misunderstanding of what we were talking about. And obviously, as the title alludes to, I think that antinomians, like Bigfoot and unicorns, don't actually truly exist. Now, that needs a little bit of explanation, because antinomian, what does this mean? Well, anti from the word anti, meaning against, and then, I'm just kidding, that's not what it means, and then nomian from the word nomos, which means law. And basically what's happened is that when people, and Paul alluded to this last night, when people have a discussion of the gospel and it becomes clear that there may in fact be a loosening of the restraints, that you might actually take the padlock off the tiger's cage, as it were, well, people get nervous. People both in their own lives and around those people get nervous and say, now, wait a minute. Are you saying that tigers shouldn't be in cages? Are you saying that I can do whatever I want? Are you saying that none of the things that people have done to hurt me actually mean something? That's what people are really hearing. Because no one is really afraid of themselves having too much freedom, unless they have come to a place where that's a confession, as we'll hear about in another talk. But most people are only worried about other people having too much freedom. And in particular, my father, who had way too much freedom to drink way too much and come home way too late. I mean, not my father, but analogously, you know, the father of romantic poetry. Or my sister seems to have too much freedom because she never has the freedom to call me. Or my any number of things. The person who hurt me had too much freedom. So when you are talking about forgiving them and giving them freedom, well, what you're actually doing is saying that what they did to me didn't matter. And the tragedy of that reaction to me is that they don't, the people who have that, you know, on one hand, as a pastor, you want to go hug them and say, of course, that's not what we mean. Of course, that's not what we mean. But on the other hand, you also want to say, you haven't heard what we're singing, as it were, because the plausibility structure within you, within which you live your life, has made you tone deaf to what we're actually saying. Because if you keep using this metaphor, I will probably beat this into the ground of from Psalm 40, you know, that all people who are Christians who learn how to play the guitar immediately thank you two for putting to music, because you get to sing this Psalm 40 refrain, you know, how long to sing this song, you know, and you're like, look how cool I am a Christian, but I'm also hip, you know, look, I have a guitar. You see where that gets you. But you have this idea that there is an alternative song being sung, that there's a soundtrack to the same life that is opened up to one by faith as opposed to unfaith. And this goes back to what we talked about in the beginning about the plausibility structures, that the same life of birth and struggle and disappointment and sadness and childlessness or too many children or divorce and then ultimately death, the same life has one of two soundtracks. One is rejoicing along the way in sorrow, weeping with those who weep, rejoicing with those who rejoice, knowing that this is yet not the final word, whereas the other one is clawing and grasping and being dragged and leaving the fingernail all the way to the end. So how do we get there? What is that all about? Well, this is where the heavy lifting takes a little bit, and I apologize for, I don't apologize actually, but it'll take a moment to get through, so hold on, and I'm going to get through it. But we have to understand that the completely non-abstract relationship that the Bible reveals to us in Scripture about these important relationships between sin, faith, life, love, and death. Don't worry, I want to address all of those together, but I will use as my touch point the verse from 1 Corinthians 15, because you remember, this is 1 Corinthians 15 is where the Apostle Paul is making the audacious claim that unlike the completely abstract Platonic idea of the immortality of the soul, we actually believe that our bodies, like Jesus's body, will be raised in a breathing, living, sweating, hairy, beard-having way. And they were like, nuh-uh, Paul, that's crazy. And he says, I know, believe me, I couldn't make this stuff up, but there you go. And he says something very powerful. He says that when the perishable, i.e. us, put on the imperishable, and the mortal puts on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? Then he says this, the sting of death is sin. The power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, we have to go all the way back to the beginning. What is the touch point with our lives and everyone else around us? Yes, it's death. I mean, that's something we could talk about forever, but yes, we're going to run from death, and we're scared of it, and there you have it. But it's also love. Love is something that is unique to people's lives. Now, the problem for us is that love, in light of the reality of death, actually becomes a curse. So you begin to see that the good things in life, the beauty of your child, is immediately tainted by the fact that you will not see their grandchildren. Or the beauty of your wedding day is immediately tempted and tainted by the fact that you have just said, for better or worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health, until death do we part. The beauty of a job, the beauty of a flower, as it were, any number of things that are actually true and beautiful and good, i.e. love, in light of the finitude of life, become the curse. Now you begin to hear how, remember, Jesus himself said, what is the two great commandments? What are the commandments? What are the laws? Love God and love your neighbor. And what is the law, according to Paul? A curse. So you begin to see that the actual deep human image of God within us, which is our ability, desire, and need to love outside of the, as it were, Christian plausibility structure of the resurrection of the body, becomes the very curse that condemns us all to lives, as it were, of anxiety. Because we're waiting for the next shoe to drop. We're waiting for the diagnosis to come in. We're waiting for any of the things that we have heard expressed much more beautiful than I can do it here this weekend. In essence, we're waiting for the law to finally have its say. And the law, as we hear from the Apostle Paul, is the power of sin is the law. Now, what does this mean? Well, one of the great tragedies, which Kierkegaard would have agreed with when he said that the church has done the impossible thing, it's not to make the gospel less relevant, it's to make it boring. You know, I mean, that's a paraphrase, but and I think one of the things, the ways they've done that is by baptizing a certain Victorian moralism and turning Jesus and the whole church into good little boys, you know, I mean, basically what Sally Lloyd-Jones was skewering, good little boys don't do this, good little girls do that, and you know, Jesus is up there with a ruler going to smack you on the hand. And the great tragedy of that is that sin is actually a state within which people find themselves operating. Luther had this great analogy of this when he talked about what happened with Adam and Eve. He said that once they ate the apple, well, that was a sin, an action. But the actual existence of sin entered the world the moment that they believed the lie that God did not really say. And what that means by that is that they essentially stopped believing in God, their loving Father, their Creator, the one who had their lives in his hands and created them. The moment they began to step out of that plausibility structure, well, then they were left to their own devices. And they were left under the desire, demand, and need to love in light of its end, which then subjugated them to a life of slavery. And so we have the history of the world is simply the writ large picture of people when divested, who are driven by the law of love, which is good, meet, and right, when it is seen as something that must be protected from decay and demise because it someday will be ripped out of my hands, well, then you have fenced neighborhoods. Then you have pyramids. Then you have the wars that was launched by, you know, the face that launched 1,000 ships. Then you have families that break apart because, well, love has gone. Or then you have the world, as it were, that is simply individual people fighting for their little finite piece of the pie for as long as they can hold on. And into this world came Jesus saying, do not worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow has its own worries. Worry about today. And who are you to worry anyway? Look at the Lord who cares about the sparrow. Or where I'm going, you do not know, but don't worry. There are many, many rooms. But take heart, because in this world you will have trouble, but I have overcome the world. In essence, he said, listen, you people who have misguided, misdirected, and implausible plausibility structures, let me offer you mine. Let me show you the way. Let me be, in fact, love for you. And so we find ourselves in a situation where the deep empathy we have with people is based upon the fact that we actually can identify and sympathize and empathize with all of the things that drive them as much as they drive us. Our desires for peaceful existence, our need to avoid pain, the hopes that our children will have a better world than we will. These are not bad in and of themselves. But when it's all that you have to hold on to in light of the finitude of life, well, then it's no wonder that people take up arms to defend people who come against them in that pursuit. So we are those people who say that our plausibility structure has been so radically reoriented around the crucified and risen Lord that we are now those people who lay down our weapons. You lay down your weapon. There's no enemy in front of you anymore because death has lost its sting, because your life is now a living witness, as the Apostle Paul says, a living sacrifice, not to the onward and upward trajectory of glory, but in the midst of the darkness, you will be the light. Your audacity in the face of sickness, in the face of wars, in the face of any number of things that have always beset a broken and fallen world, your witness will be that this is not the final word. And so when we talk to people about antinomianism, I mean, if they want to talk to me and say, well, are you against laws, you know, prohibiting murder? Well, of course not. Are you saying that people can do whatever they want and no one should care, and if we do care, you're illegal? Well, of course not. But am I saying that any of us will escape the wages of sin? No. Am I saying that I would there was another way? Then through the valley of the shadow of death, I, along with Jesus, would have signed up for it. Remember, take this cup from me, Lord. And yet not my will but thine. And so I find myself in a situation. I've been reading, it sounds pretentious, but it's not. I was reading, it might be a Shakespeare, Hamlet soliloquy the other day, because I was interested in this, you know, the shuffling off the mortal coil, you know, this phrase from this. And I ran across his soliloquy, which I read again. And you remember this, where he's talking about death. And he talks about it and he says, for in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. And he begins to talk about that we would never put up with this life but for the fact that we aren't sure that the next one's going to be better. Because what dreams might come in that sleep? And he has this whole talk about it, and I'm so deeply touched by that, because this is the non-abstract place where the Christian message interacts with the, as it were, anxieties of the world. And it's the same place that it interacted with the anxieties of the first century world, and it's the same place it will interact with the 31st century world, because the desire for there to be meaning and hope and purpose in life is so deeply embedded in us that when we have none, we ultimately become those people who are living, as the Apostle Paul says, under wrath. And so the world under judgment is one that has found itself in the unenviable and, in fact, double-bind position of having to make meaning where there doesn't seem to be any meaning at all. And that's been the world from the beginning until the end. And into this world came the crazy message that before you were born, I knew how many hairs were in your head. That before you even took a breath, I knew your parents. That you can lift your eyes up to the hills. From where does your help come from? The Lord, who the creator of heaven and earth. And so we find ourselves in this situation where we are these Christians who, yes, we know the sleep is coming, Hamlet, but we're not afraid of the dream that's coming after that. And that is the message that changed the world. and connects with people at every point of their existence, because it's the only one that we have, and it's the at the place of deepest need. I mean, I'm always reacting to this Marx in my head, you know, that religion is the opiate of the masses. And I remember very much Gerhard Aveling, who's a theologian friend, well, a hero, I've never met him, but a friend of mine, hero, and he said, you know, we just because a God comes to fulfill a need shouldn't invalidate that claim. I mean, it would be like if we were all in the desert and I showed up with an ice cream. I mean, more dirt, and was like, here, I have exactly what you're all looking for. We probably would look for another God if that was the case, like one that brought water, as it were. And the point of that is that we shouldn't be surprised that Jesus, who claimed to be God, I mean, who in his actions on earth, actually by his life answered the one thing that people needed. He came to a desert and brought water. And so whatever else he brings, it's secondary to the fact. Now let's have a conversation over our newly slaked thirst, Jesus. Wonderful. In conclusion, I did get there. There's an analogy that I like to use, and if you've listened to my sermons, if you're the one that listens to them online, I apologize, I do use it. But this is what I think we're involved with here, and this is why there are no antinomians, truly, because I'm reminded, I was at a, I grew up in Baton Rouge, and we took a great, glorious vacation to Opryland, USA, in Dollywood, in Nashville, and it was awesome. It was we weren't in an RV; we were in the family truckster, but it was awesome. And there's a roller coaster there, an upside down roller coaster, which I was of the tender age of 12, very afraid of. And my dad was, sort of, I think, ashamed that I was afraid, just because, like, come on, son, be a man, but come with me, and we're going to go on this ride. And I was terrified, deeply terrified. And I remember taking great heart, for the line was, long, long, snaking line, is the only thing that got me onto that ride was the fact that people kept walking off the exit. And I keep looking at them, and I was like, I would examine them, I was like, is anyone crying? Is there, like, a weapon? Is somebody lose control of their, bladder or something? What took place? And everyone's slapping their back, And analogously, like Heidegger said, this Gewürfenheit, we're thrown into the world. And like Camus says in The Myth of Sisyphus, I mean, the great question is there meaning or not? And if you come to a place that some have and say, there is no meaning, well, we can't talk. But if you're someone like everyone else who actually says, well, there probably is some meaning, that this love that I have for my family or my child or that I even want for myself, there must be something behind that. Well, then you have been thrown with the rest of us onto the train, as it were, of life that is climbing slowly. And for some people, it crests very early. But for most people with hygiene and peacetime and medicine, it takes about 85 to 95 years. And the only hope for the fight that takes place on that ascent is that one person has come off. One person has walked off out the exit. And he, by that walking off, changed the plausibility structure of all who saw him, so much so that they no longer feared the ascent and even brought it on themselves faster by having the audacity to sound like crazy people and walk into a world saying, you're never going to believe it, but guess what I saw. And so as we walk out of here ourselves, we are those people who have, hopefully, because we know that no one escapes the law, ourselves included, we are those people who have the deepest empathy for what dreams may come and the fears that that actually does produce. But into that fear, we can preach with the Apostle Paul that what you are worried about has been revealed. He has told you to lay your burdens down. Come to the well and drink from the water that will never run dry. Thanks be to God. Amen.